it's been proven. When Jews retreat and when Jews leave a land, it is filled by a vacuum of terrorism. That's who our enemy is. We left Gaza in 2005 thinking that we would improve matters. We have fewer dead Jews. We have many, many more dead Jews because we left Gaza. So by settling there, it's not to say it would be easy. It's not to say that it wouldn't come with risks or dangers, but I think the dangers are greater by pulling out.
I'm Scott Kahn, and this is the Orthodox Conundrum. This is the Orthodox Conundrum on JewishCoffeeHouse.com. I'm Scott Kahn. In some recent episodes of this podcast, we've discussed numerous issues relevant to the religious Zionist world, including some of the ways that religious Zionism differs from modern Orthodoxy. But religious Zionism is not a monolith. There are many different paths within religious Zionism, and the differences between these paths can sometimes be vast. For example, as I pointed out in an article on my Substack last month, the Mafdal, that is Mifleget Dati Lumi, the old religious Zionist party, which dominated religious Zionist politics for decades, was, during the Six-Day War, perhaps the most dovish and anti-war of all the parties in the labor-led government of the time. Today, of course, the dominant ideology within religious Zionism is associated with the philosophy of rabbis like Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook and others who founded the settlement movement. But even though modern political religious Zionism is generally associated with the right or even the far right on the Israeli political spectrum, the other strains within religious Zionism still exist, albeit less so in the political arena. In order to discuss the future of religious Zionism, I invited my friends Daniel Goldman and Rabbi Elie Michel to talk about it with me on the Orthodox Conundrum. But the issue of settlements and the question of a Palestinian state took up so much time that we decided to make this episode part one and deal with the other pressing issues in part two. So this episode largely deals with the different attitudes towards the maintenance and expansion of settlements in the West Bank, the issue of whether to create a permanent civilian presence in Gaza, the future of the Palestinians who live in the West Bank and Gaza, and whether that future should include an independent Palestinian state, questions around the democratic character of Israel and whether Israel should be bound by international law, whether to relate to Tanakh as history or as a practical guide, and much more. We'll begin that conversation in just a moment. First, let me remind you to subscribe to the Orthodox Conundrum podcast wherever you get your podcasts, and please rate it and write a review. Please subscribe to my Substack, Orthodox Conundrum Commentary. Last week, I published an article there entitled "He Did It," about the Meron disaster, Prime Minister Netanyahu's refusal to take any responsibility, even as a commission of inquiry just last week found him personally responsible, and how in Tanakh, taking responsibility is shown to be the difference between leaders who maintain their rule and leaders who don't. The link is in the description of this podcast, so get your free subscription today. And finally, remember that JCH Podcast Productions is the best place for you to go in order to produce your podcast from start to finish. Write to me at scott@jewishcoffeehouse.com so that we can discuss helping you make a high-quality, professional, and popular podcast. Rabbi Elie Michel is the Director of Education at Israel 365, where he works to build bridges between Jews and Christians in support of Israel, and he's the editor of HaMizrahi magazine. Before making Aliyah, he served as the rabbi of Congregation Suburban Torah in Livingston, New Jersey. Daniel Goldman is the founding partner of Gold Rock Capital and founder of the Institute for Jewish and Zionist Research. He is a businessman and social activist. He currently co-chairs the Coalition for Haredi Employment and is a former chair of Gesher and World B'nai Akiva. Daniel Goldman and Rabbi Elie Michel, thank you very much for joining me today on the Orthodox Conundrum podcast.
Morning, Scott. Morning, Elie.
Great to be here.
I'd like to start off with a broad and general question. We'll deal with some of the actual details shortly. And this question will sort of set the stage for what we're going to be talking about today. Rav Elie, we'll start with you. Are you generally satisfied with the direction in which religious Zionism in Israel today is heading?
Unequivocally, yes. Nothing is perfect. But if we see what's happening today at the front in Gaza, we see that the religious Zionist movement is at the forefront of Am Yisrael. I can say this, I think, very proudly and without arrogance, but I think that we are the leading tribe of the people of Israel today, and we're setting the tone, even though we're a minority, very much a minority in this country, even still with all the growth, we are setting the tone for the future of Israel. More religious Zionist soldiers have died way out of proportion with our numbers. somewhere between 35, 40, even 50%. You'll see different percentages, which is really extraordinary. And the way that we're impacting people, both I think to the right and to the and also to in the secular world as well, is extraordinary. So there are always going to be imperfections, but without doubt, I think that the direction of religious Zionism today is incredible. We have so much to be proud of.
Okay. Daniel, how about you?
I would say, I think much of what Ellie has described is something that I could definitely sign up to. There's a tremendous amount for everybody to be proud of in the religious Zionist community. I think that was true before the 7th of October, actually, and has clearly been reflected in amazing sacrifice and mesirut nefesh that we've seen across the board. Of course, we've seen that pretty much across the board in all of the, let's call it, serving sections, and maybe we'll get to that a bit later, of the Israeli community, but it's been an unbelievable experience. Obviously, very tragic to see in one's own neighborhood the effects of that, but so I think from that perspective, the basic ideal of being a religious Zionist, meaning somebody my first command is to contribute to Israeli society, I think we come out with a pretty high score. I might be a little bit more sanguine than Ellie on certain of the other aspects that are affecting the community and some of the trends, which maybe we will get into a little bit later. I'm personally concerned about some of the more extreme or fundamental ideas that have sort of become normalized. And again, if we have time, it'd be great to get into it. I think there's a kind of arbitrage or gap between sometimes what's seen at a leadership or political leadership level and what's actually happening at the community level. I think as a community, we remain a very positive force. I am not as strident perhaps as Ellie would be in terms of we are now, you know, leading or an elite or the leading light for the rest of Israeli society, but I'm sure we'll get some of that nuance a little bit later. But we're definitely in the leadership position. There's no question.
Thank you both for explaining that. And now we're going to jump right in the deep end with one of the most important and controversial issues in which religious Zionism is enmeshed, and that is specifically the question of continued settlement building. Even the term settlement building itself is a term which is fraught with lots of meaning, and people might not like that term. But speaking about building in Yehuda Veshomron, the West Bank, and even further in Gaza, let's start off with speaking about the more normalized aspect, building more settlements, expanding settlements, or even withdrawing from settlements in Yehuda Veshomron. As a religious Zionist, Daniel, how do you feel about this? What do you think the future should bring? And I don't mean necessarily over the next year, but I mean our long-term goal.
Sure. I think it would be reasonably uncontroversial to say that I'm not reflective of the center line in the religious Zionist community. And I think it's worth mentioning for all of your viewers and listeners that probably 90% of religious Zionists in Israel would consider them to be right wing. And within that spectrum, that's obviously a pretty wide spectrum of, you know, hard right, soft right, middle right, whatever you want to call it. So I think as a generality, there is a wide support for the continued building of settlements, certainly in Yehuda Veshomron, in Judea and Samaria. I think one of the ways that I look at it over the period of now nearly 50 years of settlement and active settlement that has very much been a leadership position for the religious Zionist community, I don't think it's ever caught on as a mass movement. I don't think we've ever sort of lit up and inspired outside of the religious Zionist community the importance of settling in Judea and Samaria. In fact, in the last time I checked the numbers, and it could be I'm a little bit out of date, but about a year ago, if you look from a demographic perspective, the actual numbers in Judea and Samaria are actually dropping, not going up, especially if you exclude the growth of places like Beitar Elite and Modin Elite Kiryat Sefer, which obviously have very, very high demographic growth rates. So I think that the sense of idealism that has brought the community over, you know, the first several decades of that movement, I think in certain ways has kind of, it's dropped off. It's not as a central issue. I think where it becomes a very powerful message is on a negative side, or if you will, the negative commandment of we will not leave any settlements. And there, I think I probably sit on the margins of that argument.
Ravelli, what do you think about that? What's your feeling about the future of settlement building in Yehuda Veshomron?
So I certainly do not get that same feeling that there's a loss of idealism. In fact, they see quite the opposite. You know, we have elections today, a runoff election in Efrat, and it's very possible that there will be a new mayor because, and not because the old mayor did a bad job. He's been a wonderful mayor, I think, in all matters that are internal. But people want someone who will be more passionate about expanding Efrat, particularly about the Eitan Hill, without getting into all the details. But I sense that that idealism, at least from my experience, what I'm surrounded by, is growing. Now, obviously, you know, my own experience may not be what's happening everywhere else, but I haven't gotten that feeling in all of my conversations with people that there's a loss of idealism when it comes to settling the land. On the other hand, I do agree with Daniel that that has been one of the great failures of religious Zionist movements, is that we have not been able to get the rest of the nation to join in and to believe in and recognize the importance of the land. And we've had many proofs of that, from Oslo to the disengagement zone and so forth. But Rav Hanan Porat actually said that back in 1980, when he was responding to an article written by Rav Avinir. Rav Hanan Porat said that Gush Emunim, right, the movement that he was a key part of founding, settling the land, has been extraordinarily successful by many measures, and it certainly has. I mean, I think there's well over 500,000 Jews living in Judea and Samaria today. That is an unbelievable accomplishment. But he was also very clear that they had not succeeded yet, and I think that's still true today, in getting the rest of the nation to join in. Now, I think that might be changing. We won't know for sure until the impact of this war, is seen in the years ahead. But there's no question that Daniel's right. This has been a primarily religious Zionist initiative. That being said, this is not something which is unprecedented. I mean, I think almost everything that we're experiencing has already happened in Tanakh. And if you look at the beginning of the book of Judges in Shoftim, it's very clear, the first few chapters, that there are only a few of the tribes, and in particular, the tribe of Yehuda and also the tribes of Yosef. Those are the only two tribes that really tried to fully settle the land. All of the rest of the tribes are criticized very strongly for not getting rid of the enemies living among them in their particular tribal portions. But it was only Judah and Joseph. Only those two tribes, which actually corresponds to Judea and Samaria today, only those two tribes really did their very best to conquer all of their lands. So this is not unprecedented. It's happened before, and it may take some time for the rest of the nation to catch up. But I do believe that ultimately they will, and that all of these lands will be ours.
First of all, excellent reference to Judges. And also, I would reinforce the point that Eli makes by quoting Hanan Porat, Zichrono Livracha. It was Rav Tzvi Yehuda himself who said that unless we carry the consensus support of the people, then not only will the settlement project not be successful, but it's a doubt whether we should even be in it. I don't think that gets quoted terribly often these days. But again, as somebody brought up in B'nai Akiva and with the ideals of Eretz Yisrael, no doubt, you know, the historic lands of Israel are super important to us. The question of the practicalities, the reality, the security around that, and what that means for internal societal issues within Israel, I think are totally relevant. And to the question of the Efrat election, that is just a classic moment where an internal debate within religious Zionism is relevant for the people of Efrat, but pretty much irrelevant for everybody else. And I think, you know, when I think of the tragedy of that moment in 2005 as the disengagement was about to happen, and I think many people who were so passionate and powerful in wanting to stay within Gaza at that time, I think they had kind of expected that they would engender a much greater level of sympathy within the wider Israeli society. And when they turned around, there was basically nobody there. And I'm not sure we've moved on dramatically from that point with respect to settlements. And at the same time, Israeli society has a huge number of other challenges and issues that we need to focus on, where that same leadership that Eli talks about, we absolutely need it in other arenas. So it's not a simple, you know, you can just invest everything all the time, whether it's social capital or political capital. The question is, what are the priorities and where do we want to actually be successful?
Okay, I want to reference something you just said, Daniel, about the tragedy of 2005, which obviously is a term which some people would use, some people would not use. Perhaps a different number of people would use it today than in the past. I'd like to ask about the settlement or resettlement of Gaza. going back to Gush Katif. Daniel, what do you think about that? Do you think that's a good idea? Do you think that's a bad idea?
So I think it's a bad idea in two ways. I think it's a bad idea principally because I'm not a fan of settling areas where it's clearly not just a majority Palestinian area, but it's clearly something which is going to have huge amounts of cost in terms of being in there. And I understand that it's an argument which one could make by way of the early settlements anywhere in Israel, free the state. But I think it's a very different argument once you're in the position that we are in. And having said that, 2005 definitely had tragic elements to it. I'm not looking to go back and do that. But I think that's actually perhaps the less critical element to that. The more, I think, substantive issue that I have with it, that so much of Israeli society stands against it. And at such a critical moment where we are going to need all of the resources of solidarity that we could possibly find, something like 80% of Jewish Israeli society opposes the return to Gaza. And irrespective of what the security or financial issues are around doing that, I think it was even Elkin who said in an interview himself that he personally would have no problem going back to Gaza. So he's definitely certainly more right-wing than I am in that sense. But clearly, it's not something that we can do with so little consensual support. And again, when you see, the festivities at the conference that they had a few weeks ago in Binyanei HaUmah with several thousand people and a vast, swathe of the political leadership of the religious Zionist movement, celebrating the possibility of going back, to me, that says it's disconnected from where the rest of society is at a critical time when we need to be actually all pushing in the same direction. So I think my concern about the return to Gaza is less about my personal opinion on that and more what it might actually do in terms of Israeli society.
Eli, what's your opinion about the return to Gaza?
So I'm not sure what surveys you're seeing. I mean, I've seen other surveys that have shown much greater support for returning to Gaza. And certainly but that issue is definitely relevant, meaning we agree on this, that the people of Israel have to be behind something in order for it to be successful. There's no question. That being said, I do think many, many more people than we realize are supportive of it, and that it's changing very much in the army as well. Where the government currently is and stands is not, I don't believe it's fully aligned with where people are, and certainly our new greatest generation, these incredible young people that are serving in Gaza, we don't know exact numbers, but I think that the numbers are far higher in terms of people who want to return. But there are two other reasons why we should have as a goal the settlement of Gaza. Number one, it's been proven. When Jews retreat and when Jews leave a land, it is filled by a vacuum of terrorism. That's who our enemy is. We left Gaza in 2005 thinking that we would improve matters. We'd have fewer dead Jews. We have many, many more dead Jews because we left Gaza. So by settling there, it's not to say it would be easy. That's not to say that it wouldn't come with risks or dangers, but I think the dangers are greater by pulling out or by not resettling. But even more so, I think sometimes we get a little bit too fancy and complicated in our views, right? As opposed to just looking at what God tells us in the Torah, which is, it's very clear that Gaza is part of the land of Israel, very clear in the book of Yehoshua. And we have an obligation to settle the land. We certainly do. Now, does it have to be tomorrow? We have to do it, obviously, within the realm to some degree of reality. There's no question, right? We have to get the people behind us. But that should 1,000% be our goal. And frankly, it should be our goal that every Arab who wants to kill us and hates us and supports Hamas in Gaza should leave and go somewhere else, right? And I'll say that directly. I don't think that's radical. I think that's basic Torah, right? Where it says in the book of Bamidbar, if you don't get rid of your enemies, they will be thorns in your eyes. It's extremely clear in the Torah that we have to get rid of these people, not every Gentile. I'm not at all a radical on that front. I think there's a place for good Gentiles who support the state of Israel and help us and want to be part of it. There's absolutely a place for them. But for, unfortunately, what is the clear majority of Arabs today living in Judea, Samaria, and Gaza, right? It's clear that they support terrorism, that they support our enemies, and they should go. And I don't think that's actually controversial. if you look at the Torah, that's exactly what it tells us to do. So can we resettle it tomorrow? I'm not sure that we can do so immediately tomorrow, but that should be our stated goal. There's no question that that should be our stated goal, in my view. I think that Bibi, you know, when he talks about how we don't want to go back to Gaza, it's not realistic. So we have to be realistic to one degree, but in our aspirations, I don't think that we need to be realistic. I really don't think so. The Torah itself is not realistic. The whole Zionist project is not realistic. Right? Is it more unrealistic to resettle Gaza than it is than it was to rebuild the land of Israel when this place was completely desolate and filled with swamps and malaria? I don't think so. So I think that should be our stated goal. Whether it happens tomorrow is a different question. We have to get the people of Israel on board. And I agree with Daniel that education is absolutely critical. And that's something that religious Zionists have to do better. But I do think that that should be our stated goal, and we should not be ashamed. There are already 22 other Arab states, and there is already a Palestinian state on the other side of the Jordan. We have a tiny little country that God gave to us, which he told us very clearly, right? He created the world, and therefore he can give the land to whoever he wants to. It's in that first Rashi in Bereshit is very clear, right? That's our answer, right? We have to tell ourselves and all the world very clearly that this land belongs to us. And so Gaza is ours by divine right. And particularly when the inhabitants of Gaza are terror supporting, right? Overall, an evil people. There are, sure, there are some innocent individuals among them, but overall, they are clearly an evil people, right? I certainly believe that it's our responsibility to do our very best to remove those evil people from the land and to resettle it and to have Eretz Yisrael Ashleima.
Daniel, what did you want to add to that?
Yeah, for sure. I think come back on a couple of things. First of all, a poll that we did in the institute that I founded with Menachem Lazar, his polling company, actually what we discovered was that not even half of the religious Zionist community is in favor of settling back into Gaza, about 44%. Perhaps amusingly or ironically, 48% of the Haredi community are indeed in favor of returning to Gaza. So I think I'd definitely be happy for them to be in the lead of that. But then if you look even at the Masorti community, the traditional Jews, which makes up a reasonable minority again in Israel, 28% are in favor of returning to Gaza. And of course, of the secular Jews, 13% are in favor. So I'd be glad to see other data on that. But I think there's a huge amount of work that those who are in favor of going back to Gaza will need to do in order to turn this into a consensual opinion within Israeli society. I feel I must add, in response to Ellie's comments about removing Palestinians from Gaza and from Judea and Samaria, I think we have to go back and understand that when everybody signed up to the creation of the State of Israel, we signed up to living in a democratic regime. And also, I think for me, the beauty, the power of Zionism is the return of the Jewish people to history. And part of living within that history is also living within the reality of that history. And of course, Ellie and I will both agree that the miracle of Zionism, the return of the Jewish people to Eretz Israel and the founding of the State of Israel is something which is almost a paradox to the idea of history in the sense that it defeats everything we know about history, and much of what we do and continue to do sits on that a line between history and a kind of mystic idea in history. But ultimately, I think we have agreed to take upon ourselves to create a state that acts within democracy. It also acts within international law. And so the things that we do inside of formal Israel and beyond our formal Israel, whether it's Judea, Samaria, and certainly in Gaza, we need to act very carefully to make sure that we protect those values that we have signed up to, not just as Zionists, but also as religious Zionists. And I have to mention that programs like Treasury Minister Bezalel Smotrich and his idea for what he calls the Tochnit Achra, I'm not sure the best way of translating that into English, negates basically the potential democratic rights of the people living in Judea and Samaria. And I can only assume that those who are in favor of moving into Gaza are not interested in giving any type of democratic rights to the people of Gaza. And I think general comments about we must get rid of, or they must go, or there are 22 other Arab countries, and therefore that's where the Palestinians of Gaza ought to go. I think these are irresponsible statements that don't have any realistic chance of actually taking place. And I think if anybody ever used the same comments against Jewish populations in other parts of the world who are currently under massive pressure and conspiracy theories about what they are, their role that they play within those other societies, I think we put Israel and the Zionist ethos that we all signed up to, I think we put it all in serious danger. So yes, the Tanakh, the biblical borders of the land of Israel are what they are. The Torah, it does indeed give us a divine right to the to Eretz Yisrael. But I think where Ellie and I would perhaps disagree is how that is reflected in actual reality, real politics, and what is possible to carry in terms of where Israeli society is, and particularly within that Jewish Israeli society, who are clearly not consensual towards that. And again, I go back to the point where we've had 50 years of settlement activity driven predominantly by the religious Zionist community. It is still not catching the imagination of the rest of Israel. And I would even say that there are parts of Israeli society who consider the continued settlements in Judea and Samaria as one of the main problems of Israel, not the solution. And again, I'm not saying I would sign up necessarily to everything that is on that side of the political map, but to ignore it, I think, is to ignore where we are at in the Israeli societal reality.
You may be right that at this particular moment, it's not realistic to tell the 83% of Arabs in Judea and Samaria that fully support the Hamas slaughter, torture, and rape of October 7th to just go, right? We may not be able to practically to do that at this moment. But as we always say, Am Yisrael lo b'fachad miderech arukah, that we're not afraid of a long-term vision and the long-term road to getting to where we need to get, right? It took many, many, many hundreds of years in the land before King David finally became king, finally conquered Jerusalem, and finally destroyed the enemies that sought to kill us on all different sides. And if you look at the way that David battled our enemies, right, it's shocking to us as modern people. But frankly, I think that we need to learn, maybe not all the particulars, I think we have to go and slaughter enormous numbers of people. But David's approach, right, that there is good and evil, and that we do have to get rid of evil, those who seek to destroy us and to kill us, is something that we have to follow. And I don't think that they must go, not about every Arab, but rather they must go about terror supporting Arabs, is such a controversial statement. I think it's self-defense. It's our basic right to the land and our basic right to life, to live in this land. So that's number one. It may take a while, but little by little, our goal has to be for the people of Israel to recognize that we are surrounded by evil. There is such a thing as evil in this world, and there's only one way to deal with it, which is to destroy it. I've always wondered why it is that we have a commandment to destroy Amalek when Amalek has not existed as an independent nation. We don't know who Amalek is for thousands of years. So why is it important to remember that every single year? So this is not about committing genocide. I don't want anyone to start accusing me of saying that I'm advocating the slaughter of any people. But I think there's a fundamental idea that we're supposed to absorb each year with Parshat Zachor and this mitzvah to destroy Amalek. The people of Israel, we are an amazing, kind, just an unbelievable nation of chesed. Gemara says we are Baishanim Rachmanim Begolei Chasad, that we are modest and we're merciful. We do chesed. That's who we are. And so we sometimes have, I think, this false notion. We project ourselves onto other people and think that other people are just like us. But the reality is, right, the people who surround us in Israel today are not, lovely evangelical Christians, who come and give you a hug and bless you in the airport, right? These are people who think day and night about slaughtering me and my wife and my children, right? This is who we're surrounded by. And so we as Jews have to recognize that and realize that there is evil in the world and we are surrounded by it. That's what we mean. I think when people talk about our enemies as Amalek, I don't think anyone is saying that we should actually go ahead and slaughter millions of people. That's not the idea. But I think we need to recognize that there is evil in the world. That's number one. Number two, I would say, you mentioned that this is not a democratic. So you're right that there is a challenge, right? If we were to immediately annex Judea and Samaria and Gaza, we'd have millions of Arabs, right? And of course, they should be allowed to vote. Going to annex it, they should be allowed to. But David Friedman, Ambassador David Friedman, just a few weeks ago, he announced presented his Friedman peace plan for Israel and the Middle East. which is a sovereignty peace plan, that Israel should take sovereignty over Judea and Samaria. He addressed this question in particular, right? He says, of course, the Arabs should have local, you know, self-rule in their cities and so on in certain ways, not militarily. But when it comes to national voting, they should not be allowed to vote. And if that sounds undemocratic, well, then we can make the same claim against America, right? The people of Guam and Puerto Rico are not allowed to vote in federal elections. They're not. And so if we would allow these Arabs, right, to vote, Arabs who, remember, again, 83% of whom in Judea and Samaria support the torture, murder, and rape of October 7th. If we were to allow them to vote, it would destroy the only Jewish state, right, in existence. So if they would like to leave and go vote somewhere else, right, they can go vote in the democracies of Iran and Saudi Arabia, where they, you know, will fit in much better. They can do so, or they can stay, the law-abiding citizens, and have the local rights and do well economically. All they have to do is stop wanting to kill us. Their life would be great.
Ellie, can I ask you a question about that? Only because I do not know about Ambassador Friedman's plan. Was he speaking about the Arabs of Judea and Samaria, or was he also speaking about the current citizens of Israel proper who are Arabs, the 20% or so?
No, he's talking only about the Arabs of Judea.
Okay. Daniel, what did you want to respond to that?
I would be delighted with the Puerto Rico arrangement. Everybody knows that the law in the United States and Puerto Rico is that anybody who's in Puerto Rico has the automatic right to move to America and get citizenship and vote. So if that's the position, and I heard that Rabbi Amish Eliyahu made the same claim, I think, in the media, if that's the position of the religious Zionist movement, then I'm absolutely in favor of that.
On the other hand, it's just to point out, the people of Puerto Rico don't want to kill the people of America, by and large. 83% of Puerto Ricans are not seeking to kill you and your family.
Ellie, you introduced Puerto Rico as an idea. I'm happy to accept it. I think that's fine. I personally do not want to have the millions of Gazans or Palestinians in Judea Samaria voting for the Knesset, because actually I think that we would have the end of Israel as a Jewish and sovereign country. The problem is that my solution cannot include us losing our democratic underpinnings. And just because David Friedman happens to say that's what he agrees with Smotrich doesn't mean I have to do so too. I am very concerned with respect to the trend that the religious Zionist community is taking in terms of disrespecting the ideas of the democratic underpinnings that we have as society. I think it reflects not just in the question of Judea and Samaria. By the way, Eli, you say nobody's actually interested in killing millions of Palestinians, but only yesterday, the Rosh Yeshiva of the Hesley Yeshiva in Yafo said exactly that. A quote in the Hebrew, we can translate it any way you like. Hadin lo tichye kol neshama.
The law is, do not let any soul remain alive.
But was he referring to, that's an unfair quote. I have no idea. I didn't see that. But was that something that he said about all Arabs, or was he saying that about
No, he's talking about Gaza. He's talking about Gaza. I think we either have to make a decision that we work according to international law, or we don't work according to international law. We may like or dislike it, but ultimately, when the rubber hits the road and politics actually begins to take place, and international diplomacy is part of the life that we have taken upon ourselves. And in fact, I think, again, Ellie and I would probably disagree. In the main, that actually plays to our benefit when our number one ally and supporter keeps by our side everywhere in the international arena, and of course in the security assistance. But even setting that aside, I think once we've taken upon ourselves to be a democratic nation and live according to international law, I think the ideas which are being suggested actually undermine the very concept of what most Israelis believe in, I think, to be the Jewish state.
Ellie, I would like to ask you about international law as well. Daniel just raised that issue. Let me preface this by saying I'm not speaking about any moral issues. I'm speaking purely on a pragmatic level. I have two particular questions. Do you agree or disagree that Israel should follow international law? And second of all, I'd like to understand, what do you think would happen if Israel chose to go and, let's say, expel certain Palestinian Arabs or Gazan Arabs? What would happen in theory should the United States then withdraw its support from Israel? What would be the consequences in that situation? How would Israel survive?
So on the first question, it's a little too vague for me to respond to. I don't know what international laws we're talking about specifically, but I mean, as a general rule, I would say international law is somehow going to lead to the murder of Jewish people. That's something that I would push back on. I mean, look, it's not just international law. We see this. There are many more dead Jews today because the United States is putting pressure on Israel than there otherwise should be. Right. I won't get into individual names of people, but I've heard and spoken to many, many people, parents of soldiers who've been killed, who were only dead because Israel was fighting in a way that was, in my view, and I think the view of many other Israelis, is absolutely absurd. So I know that's not really international law. I can't respond to a vague question that way. But I think if the lives of our people are at stake, then that matters more than whatever these international laws might be. In terms of transfer, this is what I said before about transfer. I do believe that anyone who's an enemy of Israel ideally should be transferred. Whether that can practically happen right now, we have to live in the world that we're living in, right? Things don't happen necessarily overnight. And there may be opportunities in the future where if the people of Israel are ready for it, meaning if the people believe in it, then they want to get rid of our enemies who are seeking to kill us. Then when the opportunity presents itself that it's possible to do so, we'll be ready to do so and we will do so. But I'm not advocating at this moment that we stop playing by all the rules of geopolitics and put Israel in danger. Certainly not, right? So practically, a lot of the things that I would say to do today may not be all that different than what Daniel is saying. But I think in terms of what our goals are, I think that's the most important question here. And internally, where are the people of Israel headed? What do we want? What are we yearning for as a nation?
So to be clear, I'm talking about the international law with respect to how we run a war. I think those laws are fairly clear. Israel has definitely committed itself to keeping by them. I think if you look and you just take the full quote from the Rosh Yeshiva who spoke yesterday, it's very clear that he said, obviously, you should accept the orders of your commanders, but ultimately, it is the din that Gazans should be killed. And when it asked specifically, if that also include old people and so forth, he said it's the same din. I suggest, you know, we can all go and listen specifically. But he's not alone in making extremely broad statements about who should and who should not be included as legitimate targets within Gaza. And believe me, I don't think any of us have any great sympathy for the people of Gaza and what they're going through right now. Although each person that dies, particularly if they're not involved in combat, from my perspective, is a life lost. But I suspect we're going to stay with our differences on that subject.
Just to be clear, I certainly do not advocate for the IDF to go and purposely kill civilians. That being said, I do think that the way we're approaching the war right now, we're putting Jewish lives at risk. I'm sure we all have family members there whose lives are at greater risk because of the pressure that America is hypocritically putting on Israel these days. If this had happened in America, right, if terrorists from Mexico that come in and slaughtered and raped and tortured in the way that happens here, America's response, as it was in Afghanistan and all sorts of other places, and certainly during World War II, would be radically different from what they are expecting of us now. So the absolute and utter hypocrisy of President Biden and his administration is sickening. And frankly, I believe that, of course, while not seeking to kill any civilians, I think the lives of our civilians, right, to us have to matter more. That's what comes first. And if it takes killing 1,000 Gazans to save one Jewish boy or girl who's a hostage right now, I say do it because that's our responsibility. And that's those are the laws of war. We're not trying to kill civilians, but I certainly will not weep for those people. And if it could bring back even one of our hostages, go ahead.
I'd like to throw something out to both of you and move this in a bit of a theological direction right now. Because, for example, Daniel, you just mentioned quoting that Rosh Yeshiva, I believe, in Yaffa, who said, it is a din that Gazans should be killed. And similarly, I'm not going to say similarly in terms of the din, but in terms of the concept of obligation, Ellie, you earlier mentioned, Gaza is part of the land of Israel, and we have an obligation to settle the land. I'm guessing that most people will agree that the Torah has certain normative obligations that may not accord with our natural Western instincts and modern instincts. And I wonder what you both think about the following suggestion, that part of your difference may well be in how you understand those commandments as they apply in 2024. Whereas some people might say that the Torah remains eternal, and therefore everything it said about throwing out the seven nations, about Amalek, etc., simply should be applied nowadays in its parallel to the modern world. maybe we're not going to call the Palestinians Amalek, but we're going to say they're somewhat akin to the seven nations, which need to be somehow dealt with, or else they'll be a thorn in your eyes. On the other hand, someone might say, yes, the Torah is eternal. We're religious Zionists. As religious Zionists, we do believe in the eternity of the Torah. But that commandment in the Torah was speaking about a time when, number one, there was active prophecy, and therefore God himself is telling us how to act in a certain situation with certain guarantees of safety, which we no longer have. And number two, the Torah was speaking about specific nations that were pagan nations in a specific time, and you simply cannot apply those dinim, those laws, to the modern-day Palestinians. They simply are not genetically or in terms of their beliefs. They're not pagans. They're not the same people as the original seven nations. I'm curious if you'll agree with my distinction between your large worldviews, if that really is what's going on here or not. Ellie, do you agree with what I just said?
I do believe that you're correct. And I very much believe that we are reliving Tanakh, and that Tanakh is meant to be a very clear guidebook for us. Rav Neria said that when you walk through the land of Israel, you need to walk together with a living and breathing Tanakh in your hand, right? It's a book that is unlike other books. It's a book that continues to speak to us for all generations, as Rav Yehuda Cook said. The Gemara Megillah says that we were only given those prophecies that are relevant for all time. Right, there's huge gaps in Jewish history that are not covered in our prophets. We're only given the ones that we needed for our time and for all times. In particular, now when we return to the land, we've already relived the book of Yehoshua. We return to the land. The last 50 years, we were reliving the book of Judges, where we're trying to hold on to the land, internal fighting among the tribes, and simply trying to fight back against the resurgent enemies within the land. And I think that we're heading into the book of Shmuel now, the book of Samuel. These books are living and breathing, and they are guiding us to this day, without question. Otherwise, we turn the Torah into an academic book of history, which is very nice, but that's not, that's not what we believe. It's actually very interesting. The Christians refer to the Nevi'im Rishonim, the books of Yehoshua, Shoftim, Shmuel, Malachim. They refer to them as the historical books. We, however, Jews do not refer to them as the historical books. We call them the Nevi'im Rishonim. We call them books of prophecy. Meaning even those books that are not explicitly talking about the end times are books of prophecy that are meant to guide us today. Now, I would not go so far, and certainly me, I'm no halachic authority anyway, so I would not go so far as to make absolute leaps halachically that we can treat particular nation as Amalek, and that we can therefore have a right to slaughter millions of people. I don't know who that rabbi in Yafo is, but I certainly wouldn't agree that we can make those kinds of leaps. Certainly not somebody of my love, right? That's a matter for Gedolim, for great, great leaders of the Jewish people. But I think as a general guide for where we are today, the Tanakh is absolutely relevant. And therefore, if the Tanakh tells us that we have to retake the land, that if we don't get rid of our enemies who want to kill us, right, they will be thorns in our eyes, I think that's absolutely true. So it requires great wisdom, and we have to have great leaders to put these things together. And we have to also, again, operate within the realm of the modern world. But they have to be fused together. If they're not, then I'm not really sure what exactly is guiding us. If we're not being guided by Tanakh, what exactly is guiding us, right? I mean, I'd be curious to know.
Okay, Daniel, what do you say about that distinction?
Yeah, so first of all, I'm absolutely not a theologian. Definitely am not qualified to give learned answers academically or even and certainly not religiously, but I'd make maybe perhaps a couple of comments. I think the rabbis that I would certainly call my own do not see the Tanakh as a sort of literal or prescriptive way to run the modern state of Israel, including that obviously people like Rav Amital, Rabbi Gilad, Rav Lichterstein, and others. I don't think there's really a great deal of suggestion that we need to live out or relive in a literal sense the things that happened in the Tanakh. I think also from a halachic perspective, the Torah, Chazal, were at great pains to develop, sift out, and then sometimes radically change the things which we were commanded specifically to do in the confines of the Chumash or the Tanakh itself. I don't think anybody is expecting that we're going to return to a type of warfare where a Moshe-like figure will sit on the top of a hill with his arms up, and that will give us the victory over Amalek, or that we're going to walk around the walls of Ramallah until the walls fall down as we sound the shofar. It almost suggests to me a kind of thinking that if we're going to go in that direction, let's just go all the way, and we'll take the deep point of view and learn Torah and say Tehillim, and that will be the Magena Metzela of Eretz Yisrael. I think we run the risk of drawing overly simplistic conclusions. I don't think Eli would agree with that last comment with respect to the Charedim in any way. I certainly don't. But I think we run the risk of running into a very simplistic view of what the Tanakh is actually teaching us. I think it can remain eternal and relevant without necessarily being literal in every sense. We could probably do a series of podcasts on what that means for today's living. And let us be absolutely clear. The tragedy of the Tanakh is that David did indeed conquer Jerusalem and combine the Shvatim, but within a generation and a half of that pinnacle and the, you know, the pinnacle of Solomon building the first temple, we were a split nation, never again to be fully unified with the loss of the 10 tribes. So again, I'm very nervous about a type of reliving of the Tanakh. I find it actually almost ironic that part of religious Zionism is running into a kind of Ben-Gurion-style narrative, which kind of jumped from what he used to call Tanakh to Tashach, from the period of the Bible all the way through to 1948, missing out so much of the rabbinic development of Judaism. In fact, all of the rabbinic development of Judaism that comes in between. I don't think that's a religious Zionist position at all. And when I hear certain leaders saying, well, actually, we are returning to some kind of Davidic monarchical system, actually, that makes me tremendously nervous. And again, I think it actually stretches the ability for us to build our nation together in a unified manner.
Daniel, that's a very interesting point when you speak about the return to a biblical Judaism and sort of ignoring the Torah Shebaal Peh Judaism that we've been living in for thousands of years. I'm wondering, Eli, what you think about that. I'll give an example. When Chazal say that we no longer know who Amalek is and therefore the law isn't operative, there are many modern Orthodox thinkers who have spoken about this is a methodology of trying to reconcile our sense of morality with what the Torah says is the din. So it's not just that historically we don't know who Amalek is anymore, but it's also that we're sort of, and I don't want to be disrespectful, but we're avoiding the moral issue by saying, well, it's no longer operative, so we don't have to deal with that. Are you worried that going back to a, I'm going to call it biblical Judaism, you may very well say that's not what's happening, and that's part of the question too, but are you worried that going back to those mitzvot, looking at the Torah and the Bible in general as a direct guide, the first books of the Nevi'im are not historical books, but nevuah that we need to implement, will in some ways not get and not deal with some of the subsequent, I'm not going to call them developments, but innovations of Torah Shebaal Peh that have said, well, this is no longer operable. What do you think about that?
And I in no way am saying that we should reject the Torah Shebaal Peh. Certainly not.
I know
they
that,
must,
yes.
They absolutely must go together. Absolutely. And look, it's, I think even just looking at together, that we have to have, that we have to be following Tanakh and Torah Shebaal Peh. You know, we can explain some of the ways that the state of Israel have gone off the path in recent years. Meaning, for example, the Gilad Shalit deal was a direct violation of the rabbinic statement that we don't pay exorbitant prices in order to release a hostage, right? And really, frankly, the national sins of Israel over the last many years, which I think would include Oslo, the disengagement, and the Gilad Shalit deal, all of which led to the murder of thousands and thousands of Jews, right, were a violation not only of Tanakh, really, frankly, of Halacha, and the vast majority of rabbis in all of those cases were against those things. And even though I know there were some who were for it, but I think history has proven that those minority of rabbis who supported Oslo and so on, however wonderful and holy they are, were wrong. Meaning that was Oslo was a cruel and an horrific joke, ultimately. And so in all of those cases, the government went forward not just in violation of Tanakh, but in violation of Allah. But I would just add one more point, just to, I think, in my view, one correction of what Daniel said, where you said something that, like that if we follow this biblical approach, we would be like the Haredim. I think that's absolutely not true. Like the great Jews of the Bible, of Tanakh, right? Had a Torah, you know, in one hand and a sword in the other. And that goes from Moshe Rabbeinu on down, Shmuel, who led the people of Israel in wars, and King David, David HaMelech, right? I think that is the biblical path. And so, you know, and I just, that's one correction to that. But overall, obviously, we have two very different orientations. And I thank God the Jewish people have different views. It's a good and a healthy thing.
Okay, I agree with that. Daniel, can you continue, please?
I think we both agree that we're not on the Haredi page on that one.
I want to ask one final question. And as I have been chatting with you privately as we've been recording this, my original plan was to ask a whole bunch of questions about religious Zionism. And we got stuck, I think in a good way, on a very specific, perhaps the most controversial issue. So with your permission, I'd like to continue this conversation in our next episode so that we can deal with all the other issues, or at least a good number of the other issues that are confronting the religious Zionist world right now. Let me conclude now part one with a question about how you see the future of that Palestinian entity. In other words, we've already dealt with it sort of obliquely, but if we want to talk about your goal for the future and practically speaking, both of those questions, what should the future be of the Palestinians? Should they have a state? Should they have something less than a state? What, in your views, should be that future? And I'll ask alongside that, how will you deal with the problem of a non-Jewish population if you say there should be no state and they get citizenship, then they can vote Israel out of existence? If the West Bank is annexed and there's no Palestinian state and the residents there do not become citizens, then what until now has been a canard, apartheid, might then actually have some justification. Because it's one thing to call the West Bank and Gaza, for that matter, disputed territory, and therefore the people who are living there don't become citizens of Israel. If that officially becomes part of Israel, and yet people born there remain non-citizens, you have a real problem with apartheid. How would you each deal with that? I'll start with you, Daniel, then I'll ask Ellie the same question.
Yeah. In all honesty, I have not found a conclusion to that question that I feel comfortable with. I think I would say that the security and long-term stability of Israel is the number one driver for me when I'm thinking about those questions. Obviously, that also includes maintaining Israel as a sovereign Israeli and Jewish country. I personally have a great deal of difficulty seeing any solution which would extend Israeli sovereignty into areas where we do not give full democratic rights to the citizens in that arena. And given that, I think Ellie and I both agree that that's going to be a very difficult thing to do, given what we know about that local population, I don't have a clear-cut idea or solution. I'm not embarrassed to say that it is beyond my pay grade to figure out at this point what that looks like at the end of days. I will say something which, this may or may not be controversial. One of the things which struck me so dramatically at the beginning of the war were statements that were coming out of the German government in support of Israel. There was one particular very long monologue. I think it was the foreign minister, and he might know this better than I do. I think it was the foreign minister or maybe the ambassador. I don't remember that he recorded a very long monologue in German with very detailed and specific support of Israel's position and its right to self-defense and obviously its right to, the Jewish right to self-rule, et cetera. And all I could think of was, where was the German government 80 years ago? Where are they today? And this is not to say that I am, you know, utopian driven and think tomorrow morning that Palestinians either in Judea and Samaria or Gaza are going to turn into, you know, Zionists or the lovers of Jews or Israel. But I think actually as Jews, we live on the strategy of hope, which says we can change the reality that surrounds us. And whilst I do not have a good solution and certainly not one that Ellie would be especially happy with, but I think there is no immediate solution that actually can satisfy my Zionist values and also my religious values, which I actually don't see as two dramatically different things. So I don't have a good answer to that question at this point. So yes, security and keeping with our, you know, underlying values are two things which we will have to keep in mind. I do not know how you resolve those things at this point.
A lot of the time people get into big trouble by saying we have to do something when the actual answer is, I don't know the answer. Maybe we should wait and see how things play out. Ellie, how would you respond to the questions that I asked?
Just first, one small response, you know, to the German comparison. The reason that the Germans are, and they're not, and frankly, many, many Germans are still working against us, supporting illegal Arab building and terrorism in Judea and Samaria. But the reason the Germans are not the Nazis anymore, is, and the reason why the Japanese are not seeking to destroy us, is because they were utterly and completely defeated. My friend and colleague, Rabbi Pesach Walicki, has written about this. The only way to uproot an evil ideology this way is to completely and utterly destroy the evil and make it 1,000% clear that holding on to that evil ideology will get you nowhere. So, you know, that's something that we have to do first, which America is working very hard to prevent us from doing, from utterly defeating this enemy. If you ask me, what is my vision for the future, right? This is not something that can immediately and practically happen today. But I do think that our idea, you know, the ideal future involves the majority of these Palestinians, so they call themselves Palestinians, or these Arabs, in Judea, Samaria, and Gaza, who are our enemies, leaving the country. And with the minority of them that can accept Israel and can frankly become patriots of Israel, having the right to stay and ultimately having the right to vote. It'll be a much smaller percentage, and they could be part of Israel as Ger Toshav. I'm actually on this front, you know, I feel that we have to be a lot stronger against our enemies, but also a lot kinder to those who are seeking to help us. So if there are Christians, Muslims who are living in the land, who are full-on patriotic, who are not proselytizing or anything of that nature, but who are fully, you know, fully Zionistic and sending their sons to the army, they have a place in Israel. And I think they should ultimately become citizens. But the great majority who don't, they've got to go. Now, practically, can that happen today? I agree with you, Daniel, that cannot happen today. So in terms of my practical advice for the Israeli government, because I'm sure they're listening to me, I would say, you know, please don't make any decisions that will preclude our future, right? Our ideal future. So that might be the Friedman plan, right? A plan like that, which moves us toward that future, could be a good option. But again, I will say, you know, I appreciate Daniel's humility, and I'll put myself in there as well. At the end of the day, you know, I'm just a guy living in a frat, so I don't have all the wisdom. But that would be my main point. Let us not preclude the ideal future of the people of Israel. We are people of dreamers, a people of chazon, vision, and the vision of God. The vision, right, is the vision that has to be our vision. That's a vision of Am Yisrael living in all of Eretz Yisrael in safety and security, and altogether worshiping the one God. So that has to be our goal. And so hopefully whatever we do will bring us another step closer to that.
I just make one. First of all, I think those final comments is something I could sign up to. The only thing that I would add to that is I think we have around about 20% Arabs living in the state of Israel. I think Israel has an enormous historic opportunity. One might even say responsibility, but I actually see it as an opportunity. And here I very much connect with what Eli says about incentivizing in a positive way those who are actually willing and capable of living within an Israeli Jewish country in a way where, from their perspective, they can accept that. I think we have a huge opportunity to show that within the borders of Israel, we can actually make that happen in a truly successful manner. The government actually has a tremendous amount of tools and ability to do that. I don't think this podcast is to get into and analyze whether this or that government is doing a good job on that front. But I think as an in principle position, I think that is the way for us to show how returning to history means we can also make space for and have those who are not Jewish living in the land in a successful manner. And if we sort of connect back up to sort of where the beginning of the conversation was, one of the things which, you know, joined us in tragedy on the 7th of October was that the Hamas terrorists not only targeted Jews as they came across into the southern Negev, the western Negev, but obviously they also attacked and murdered mercilessly Arabs, Bedouin Arabs. They kidnapped many of them. And there were acts of bravery on the part of the Israeli Arab community, and actually growth in support for the idea of dealing with Hamas from within the Israeli Arab community. These are signs of hope, which I think we need to develop and take opportunity to progress, not just because it's smart within the borders, of Israel. But I think the type of message that Ellie wants to deliver also to Palestinians who live or Arabs who live outside of the state of Israel, they also, I think, will benefit if we can make that more successful also within Israel.
I appreciate both of you being honest and expressing your position so articulately. So Rabbi Ellie Michel and Daniel Goldman, thank you for joining me, and I'm looking forward to part 2.
Me too.
Same here.
Subscribe to The Orthodox Conundrum on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or anywhere else you get your podcasts. Please visit JewishCoffeeHouse.com for other episodes of The Orthodox Conundrum, as well as many other great podcasts, including Intimate Judaism, The Maimonides Minute, Chochmat Nashim, The Francisca Show, and Let My People Eat. I'd appreciate it if you go to Apple Podcasts and rate and review The Orthodox Conundrum. It takes literally 2 minutes. It's just giving a certain number of stars and writing one or two sentences. Please like The Orthodox Conundrum podcast on Facebook and join our growing Facebook group, The Orthodox Conundrum Discussion Group, where you can feel free to discuss issues in Orthodoxy in an honest and friendly environment. I hope you'll become a Jewish Coffeehouse patron on Patreon. Just click on the link in the description of this podcast, and you can get bonus episodes, Jewish Coffeehouse merch, and more. You'll get special episodes on all sorts of topics that are only available to subscribers, and you'll be helping Jewish Coffeehouse spread our message of a welcoming, intellectually engaged, and honest Orthodoxy. Just join Patreon. It's only a couple of dollars a month, and you can stop anytime, so join today. Finally, do you have a message that needs to get out? Do you want to promote your business, your organization, or your cause? The best way is by producing a podcast, and Jewish Coffee House can make it happen. I have experience producing hundreds of podcasts, both for myself and for satisfied clients. Whether you want to learn everything you need in one day, or relax and record and let me do the heavy lifting, Jewish Coffee House Productions will work with you to make it happen and make it even better than you imagined. Let me help you today. Write to me at scott@jewishcoffeehouse.com or go to jewishcoffeehouse.com, click on Productions, and sign up for a free consultation. Make your voice heard, promote your cause, sell your product, and engage an audience now. I'm Scott Kahn. This has been The Orthodox Conundrum on jewishcoffeehouse.com.